So we'll continue talking about the stages of enlightenment from the flower ornament scripture. This is talk number 3. So as a kind of a review, a review for those of you who've listened to the first two talks, we've heard about the bodhisattvas entering the stage of extreme joy, the stage of purity or practice of the precepts, the stage of brilliance, which is called, the state of brilliance, which is called the stage of refulgence, and the stage of blazing radiance of the teachings. So today, we enter the stages of difficult to conquer and presence, or sometimes called presence of unattached knowledge. Yes?
I'm just wondering, do you think that maybe these are, that they might be kind of like a circle? Like maybe the stages go through them and then maybe you go through them again at a different level?
Yeah, oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Because if we don't think of it like that, then it's like we could think, well, okay, difficult to conquer. I'm totally not there, so why am I even hearing about it? But we are there. It's just that then we'll have a chance to go deeper at some other point. So difficult to conquer. So it's said that the bodhisattvas, the enlightening beings, the beings who have aroused the thought of enlightenment, who have aroused bodhicitta, which is a deep wish for the happiness of all beings, or the mind of enlightenment. So those bodhisattvas enter this stage of difficult to conquer, it's said, by the tenfold impartiality. There's always ten, right? Tenfold impartiality with purity of the mind purity as focus of the mind. And so then it talks about all of the ten. But first let me just say impartiality in general means not picking and choosing. So just accepting. And then purity as a focus of the mind is outlined. I'll just kind of summarize what the tenfold is. Focusing on the purity of the teachings of past, present, and future Buddhas. So that's kind of interesting. We get to focus on future Buddhas. How do we do that? I don't know. Just opening. So focusing on the mind is focused on the purity of the teachings of past, present, and future Buddhas. The mind is focused on the purity of practicing good conduct, of removal of views and doubt, and removal of perplexity and uncertainty. So that's where the question of faith came up yesterday, I think. So how can we go in the direction of removing doubt and also perplexity and uncertainty? And also the purity of mind has to do with knowledge of right and wrong paths. And then there's a few other things too. I didn't name all the ten. So in this stage of difficult to conquer, there's this vast, wide open quality. So that's partly the impartiality and purity of mind part. There's this vast, wide open quality. And there's also, it talks about very precise, particular upright activities. So the question is, how can you do precise, particular upright activities without picking and choosing? How can we do that? I mean, our logical mind kind of says, no, that's not really possible. And I think this is difficult to conquer. I mean, I think that's maybe why it's called difficult to conquer.
Or is it you become an difficult to conquer?
Oh, yeah, it could be that too.
I just wondered which is.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't really explain which.
Okay.
So that's a good one.
All right.
Yeah.
I don't know, but I was curious.
Yeah, I think it could go that way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably both, given the way this sutra goes. So what we'll see in this stage is actually, it seems to be a lot about right livelihood or work practice, like what people are doing in their lives, in their work. So I want to say a little more about how bodhisattvas enter this stage. So I'll read a little something on that. So it says, clothed in conscience and modesty, wise, with the fragrance of pure conduct, with the garland of the elements of enlightenment. And by the way, one translation of the Avatamsaka Sutra, this sutra is called the Flower Garland Sutra. So this translation calls it the Flower Ornament Scripture. But anyway, garlands are mentioned a lot. So, clothed in conscience and modesty, wise, with the fragrance of pure conduct, with the garland of the elements of enlightenment, the unguent of high meditation, with excellent methods adorned by wisdom and reflection, entering the garden of mental command, they come to this fifth stage. The four bases of mystic power, their feet, pure mindfulness, their necks, noblest kindness and compassion, their eyes, lofty wisdom, their teeth, the roar of selflessness overcoming the thieving afflictions, the human lions, so that's the, maybe that's the difficult to conquer, they're human lions, all right? The human lions, equanimous, wise, enter this fifth stage. So just kind of a note, when, you know, there's these metaphors that are often used, and here I kind of see this as, this is a memorization device. When you say the four bases of mystic power, their feet, pure mindfulness, their necks, noblest kindness and compassion, their eyes, lofty wisdom, their teeth. So because when you're trying to memorize something, if you also visualize it and place it somewhere, then it can be easier. Although this kind of skips around, like if I was doing a memorization thing, I wouldn't go from feet to the neck. I would go feet, legs, hips, you know, like that. But anyway, yes.
I'm thinking of the difficult to conquer. I've had that in moments where I felt that. And what I noticed was that if I stuck to sort of primal virtue, mm-hmm. or a moment by moment kind of kind truth, a truth,
mm-hmm.
that it's hard for people to manipulate you or assign you motives or kind of take anything. It's just if the alignment with the teachings is safety.
Mm-hmm.
And people can't pin you with things,
mm-hmm.
because there's a willingness to just stay upright,
mm-hmm.
with like, oh, is that so? Mm-hmm. Oh, really, is that so?
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah. And even if people try to pin you with things or think they're pinning you with things from their side,
right.
you're not pinned.
Right.
So.
You're pinned. And so your whole visage isn't pinned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's good. Sullied.
Yeah, that's good. So I wanted to mention about the four bases of mystic power, which is one of the things here. And because I wasn't familiar with that, and so I was curious about it. And so I tried to look it up. I couldn't actually find specifically the four bases of mystic power, but I found a lot on the four bases of power. So I think that it's this, four bases of power, because also sometimes it's called the four bases of psychic power, which, you know, anyway. So... Well, and it seems to fit with right livelihood and work practice. So I think it probably is what it's being talked about. So what I did find was that the four bases of power are found in a sutra called the Iddhapada. Let's see, what's the whole name of it? Iddhapada Vibhanga Sutta, Analysis of the Four Bases of Power. And it's not one that's taught very widely. It said that, so this is from an online forum called Buddhism Without Boundaries. Much of the subject matter in this sutta is about psychic power. It also said in the sort of introduction that displaying psychic power to lay people is prohibited by the Vinaya. And so I also thought, oh, that probably applies to superpowers too. We talked about superpowers yesterday. So anyway, but I also learned that the four bases of power are sometimes taught to lay people in a worldly way as principles of success. And so this is interesting. It's like principles of success, but when I read these, I'm like, oh, well, this is really about how to do work practice. So it's kind of good, I think, for us to have that in mind in Sesshin. So the four bases are this. The first is called chanda, which is having a heart of zeal. To be keen to do something and do it for the love of it. To wish to bring an activity or task to its optimum fruition, not simply doing it to get it out of the way or merely for reward or material gain. So that's pretty good. And that's not always easy to do, right? Because our habit energy is either, you know, we want to get something out of it or we want to get it out of the way. So instead, it's just, can I really love it? Have it, do it with the heart of zeal. And then the second base of power is viriya, and that's to be diligent and apply oneself to a task with effort, fortitude, patience, and perseverance, not abandoning it or becoming discouraged, but striving ever onward until the, it says, success is attained. I mean, this is kind of written in a, you know, practice for success, but... success also can mean, like, yeah, spiritual success. So diligence is the second base. And the third base is called citta, and that's committing oneself to the task, establishing one's attention on the task at hand and doing it thoroughly, not allowing the mind to wander, to apply one's thought to the matter regularly and consistently, and do the task or action devotedly. So this is kind of good for also for work practice, not in Sesshin, because it's really like a lot of people do work where you have to think about it. It's not the same as like just shoveling snow or, I mean, so sometimes we get to do work like washing dishes or shoveling snow or things like that where we don't have to think a lot about it, you know, we just do it. But a lot of us have work where we do have to think about it. You know, we have to, you know, sort of make an action plan, and we have to think about if we're writing something, what we're going to write or what we're going to say or how we're going to do something or how we're going to advise someone. So here it's like it's not about not thinking about it, but it's thinking about it in a way that the mind isn't wandering and you're applying your thought regularly and consistently. So that's, I thought that was kind of good. And with devotion. And then the fourth one is vimamsa, and that is using wise investigation to diligently apply wise reflection and examine cause and effect within what one is doing and reflect on, for example, its pros and cons, gains and shortcomings or obstructions, and can be achieved by experimenting, planning, evaluating results, devising solutions and improvements in order to manage and carry out the activity so as to achieve, you know, so thinking also about, like, what did I do just then? And is this the best way to do it going forward? So that's pretty good, too, because, you know, it's like often we might have the mistaken identity that, like, being in the moment means we don't think about the future or the past. And in a way, in that moment, we aren't. But in the moment, we could also, in that moment, is a moment of thinking about the future. And then we just are applying the task there. Like, what is it? How can I think about this? Because we do things. You know, we do one thing and then we do another thing. And this practice doesn't say that you just mindlessly go about it and you don't learn from your mistakes. So this, I thought, is pretty good, where it includes evaluation as part of it. So, yes?
Could I just make a quick observation mm-hmm. about that?
Yeah.
I'm kind of blown away by that last one, because I can think of any number of places in corporate settings where I've worked where it would have been super helpful for them to hear that,
because
they're missing that last step.
Yeah.
Like, okay, we follow the plan, we do the plan, we release the product, and then, you know, this is it.
Yeah, right.
There's no loop back. And
yeah.
About, okay, what have we done? What do we do now?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I think lots of people miss that last step. I mean, I think we have a tendency here at Clouds and Water, too, in the way we do things, to sometimes forget about that last step. Like, oh, we just did this thing. We just had this big session, or we had this big event. And then it's like, oh, it's over. We're, you know, we're so relieved. So, we, you know, especially if it's like a big special event with, you know, 60 people. And, you know, so we don't often take the time to say, okay, how did it go? And I think we're getting better about it. But yeah, I do think it's great, you know. We should spread this around. Maybe we can start doing corporate advising. No, just kidding. In the Zen way. Yes.
So you said before you don't know how you do something for future Buddhas, but this is it.
Mm-hmm.
You're
mm-hmm.
setting the stage.
Yeah, you know? Right. Right. And then sort of as a shorthand to remember these four, we can say number one is love the work or activity. So that's the devotion part. And then two is tenacity or diligence. Three is dedication. And four is circumspection. So anyway, I thought that was really, really fun. So in this stage, so that's how bodhisattvas, let's see, what is it, about how they enter the stage is through some of these things, through the impartiality with purity of mind as a focus, and then looking at the basis of mystic power as one of the things, compassion, overcoming thieving afflictions.
What kind of afflictions?
Thieving. Thieving. Like steal, you know, like it's a thief. And it also says in this stage, the bodhisattvas come to know the truths. And then they list, of course, 10 truths. And the Four Noble Truths is one. That's just one. And then there's the conventional truth and ultimate truth. That's two. There's the truth of characteristics, truth of distinctions, the truth of structure, which refers to the five aggregates, form, feeling, sensation, formation, consciousness. And also in the structure is included the elements and the senses. The truth of substance, which it refers to the pressure of body and mind. I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. The truth of becoming, which is the continuity of existence, how one thing becomes another. The truth of knowledge of extinction and non-origination. The truth of entry into knowledge of the path. So that's like a sort of nod to the Eightfold Path, I think. And truth of accumulation of the knowledge of the enlightenment, or knowledge of the enlightened beings. Truth of the accumulation of knowledge of enlightened beings. So in a way, it's like some of these to me are kind of a stretch, like they just wanted to make 10. So anyway, so I'll just say a little bit about conventional and ultimate truths, although many of you are familiar with that already. But this is what the Heart Sutra is really about, is about how there's a, you know, so-called conventional truth, which is the world of this and that, the world of form, sort of what we see, how each thing is particular, how, you know, I now have gray hair, I used to have brown hair, you know, I mean, the very particular things, that's the conventional truth. The ultimate truth is beyond that. It includes all of that. It can't really be spoken of. You could sometimes say emptiness, oneness, boundless openness, no distinctions. And then the two truths are that both of those truths are there. It's not like the ultimate truth is better, although it says ultimate, sounds like it's above. So then you kind of have this idea like above it all, there's oneness, emptiness, and then, you know, like when you get into the, you know, lowly, it's the particular, but it's no, they're both upheld as truths. And so our minds, you know, really can't really grasp that. We want to sort of make it into some kind of a arrangement that we can get, but the two truths say no, they're both there and they're both equally upheld. So, and that I think is an important thing to keep in mind for understanding, especially this sutra, but really any of the teachings. So any questions or further comments on that? I just felt like I wanted to mention it, but if anyone's stuck or wants to say something else. No? Okay. And then I wanted to just mention about the truth of substance, which didn't say a lot more about this, but it did say that refers to the pressure of body and mind. So I thought, well, so for me, it's like the pressure is like what, you know, it's kind of the form. You know, it's the form and the energy, and then of the body, and then also of the mind. So, like, really upholding that we are particular bodies and minds, and the pressure is like sort of emphasizing what we can actually feel and think about in body and mind. Do you have something as
yeah.
a body
well,
work person?
Yeah, like in the subtle body, like you'll often feel like a pressure out here,
mm-hmm.
like a pressure. And I think of it as like greed. Like if a thought comes in, like, oh, we're moving towards greed. Oh, I feel some aversion. Like a feeling of the wheel going slightly off.
Mm-hmm.
Just like, I guess, being so in the center
uh-huh.
that you can keep guiding.
Yeah.
Losing the middle way, maybe.
Yeah, I think, that rings true.
Well, also what comes to my mind is when you have a dilemma in the mind.
Uh-huh.
And the pressure that you feel resolve the two truths.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a pressure there.
Yes.
I often feel.
Yeah.
And it sometimes it just takes its sweet time.
Yeah. And so this is saying just the truth of that. So just that's it. Don't have to do anything with it. Yeah.
I wonder, I mean, this might be kind of like what you're talking about. Like sometimes when I get really, really quiet and someone comes in the room, I can feel it like
mm-hmm.
myself. I can. It's like,
mm-hmm.
and I can feel like the temperature and the pressure and the
uh-huh.
And a feel. There's a feeling. There's like a yeah. It's not. I mean, it's a whole, all of that. So that might be.
Yeah, I think so too. I also think about you know some sort of exercises that I've done in various workshops where maybe you close your eyes and then someone is like walking toward you and then you say when you know that
right.
they're there and you know that and you know, and they don't have to even be this. Sometimes you can know when they're, you know, they come into a certain, you know, with your energy body. So then there's that pressure of the body. But yeah, when you're really quiet, then you might notice it further out, you know.
Yeah.
Fill everyone
sometimes.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Not because you hear,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Not a bad
yeah.
No. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that. So I don't think you
can I just say one
more? Uh-huh.
How about when somebody coughs and it feels like it's in your head?
Yeah. Yeah. So I would like to read about more about what bodhisattvas in this stage know about. So now that they've entered, and now this is what happens, what they're knowing. By means of the awareness affected by this knowledge of the truths, they know in truth that all is conditional, void, unreal, delusive, deceptive, fooling the ignorant. They become all the more compassionate toward beings, and the light of great goodwill shines forth. Supported by the power of knowledge, with concern for all beings, seeking enlightened knowledge, they examine all conditioned activities, past and future. They know for a fact how the mass of suffering of beings sprung from ignorance and craving for existence from the past, borne along in the stream of cyclic existence, never having gotten free from the dwelling of physical and mental clusters, increases. So they know how the suffering increases, and that it has no self, no being, no life, no soul, no personality, no self or personal possessions. They also know in truth whether or not there is an end, limit, or escape from their deluded wishing for the non-existent future. And then, similar to what we saw in some of the other stages, it occurs to the enlightening beings how strange and pitiful these ignorant, deluded creatures, whose countless bodies have perished, will perish, and are perishing, yet even when they are passing away, they do not give rise to dissatisfaction with the body. Instead, they increase the fetters of suffering. So there's more clinging, and you probably see that a lot with people dying.
The worst deaths are yeah. the longer people aren't
yeah.
letting go.
Right. But I mean, even for us, I mean, we are dying, you know, in this moment, you know, some of us, you know, we don't know when the time will come. You know, we can think, you know, if we're younger, it'll be longer. If we're older, it'll be quicker, but we don't really know. But we're all, you know, in Sesshin, I often like to, I don't think I'm morbid, but I often like to think of that. Like when I look at my hand, you know, reaching for an Oreoke bowl, and it's like, yeah, it's going to be dead someday. You know, it's just because then I can really, it helps me to awaken to the preciousness of this moment and also let go of clinging to it, because it's not going to be there. Yeah? What?
It's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. Right. So anyway, so this is the bodhisattva seeing, oh, these beings are just suffering, they're clinging, they're flowing along in the stream of the mundane world, not turning back from great danger and trouble, not letting go of the dwelling of the mind-body clusters. They do not reject the vipers of the elements. They are unaware of the prison of greed for happiness. They do not pull out the arrows of pride and views. I mean, we can see that in ourselves too, right? When we're there. They do not extinguish the flames of desire, hatred, and delusion. They do not disperse the darkness of ignorance. They do not evaporate the flood of craving. They do not seek an enlightened guide. Going along with maniacs, they swim around in the sea of the mundane world in the confusion of grasping of various bad thoughts. Being without refuge, they fall into intense distress and individually experience many pains, such as birth, old age, sickness, death, grief, lament, dejection, mental disturbance. For the sake of these beings who are suffering distress, without a leader, without a refuge, without a reliance, without an island of safety, without direction, in the dark, wrapped in the shell of ignorance, we, the bodhisattvas, will gather such stores of virtue and knowledge as will enable these beings to be ultimately purified, and finally, that they may arrive at the stage of unimpeded knowledge. So again, it's like that recognizing the suffering and then this wish to help and make for beings to be happy. Yes?
The difficulty for me in hearing this and a lot of the Sanskrit stuff is it becomes very dualistic in my mind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, bodhisattvas also undergo that. That was the first time in all these years I've heard that they also are pitiful.
Right, right.
At the prison of greed.
Yeah, yeah.
And I struggle with that because I tend to put things in, you know, my likes and dislikes rise, and so I have to remind myself when I'm here, wondering, because I thought it was funny and amusing. I thought, oh, no, this is, you know, it's like not out there.
Uh-huh.
It's not out there.
Right. Well, we are bodhisattvas too, and we know that we suffer, so, yeah. So, let's see. Just a couple more things before we move to the next. I'm skipping around here because some of it I'm reading from the verse section and some of it I'm reading from the prose section, so just bear with me while I find my place. So I wanted to read this part just because I love this this language. So this is a little bit more what I just read, but in verse, a short verse. They observe the past and future of the condition, those shrouded in the darkness of delusion, caught up in suffering, and rescue worldlings, rescue beings bound to this massive suffering, though they are without self or soul and equal to grass and trees. So isn't that nice? So they see the suffering and they help, they rescue. Though they are themselves are without a self or soul and equal to grass and trees. To me, that image was so powerful as a, you know, letting go of a particular idea of these beings as like particular beings. So it's they're without a self or soul equal to grass and trees. And if we, you know, think that we're a bodhisattva, an enlightening being, and like we are going to help them, you know, then we're not allowing ourselves to be equal to grass and trees. And we're kind of, and our ego is getting in there. I mean, it's still probably better to do that rather than think, well, I still have a little ego, so I better not do anything. It's like, oh, we still should do something. But maybe having in mind, it's, could I be equal to grass and trees while I do this activity? Okay. So then how do they liberate these beings? So this is where the work practice comes in. All right. So now they've sort of done all the things they needed to do to enter this stage. Knowledge of the truth, impartiality, purity of mind, developing compassion for beings by reflecting on the misery, and then the enlightening beings thus engaged in the development of sentient beings. So now it's like, okay, helping them. I want to help them. With minds continually following Buddha knowledge, engaged in unregressing goodness, intent on the search for supreme truth, practice whatever in the world would benefit sentient beings, such as writing, teaching, mathematics, sciences of various realms or elements, medical sciences, prevention of consumption, epilepsy, and possession, warding off poison, zombies, and witchcraft, song and dance, drama, music, storytelling, and entertainment. The construction of villages, cities, parks, canals, reservoirs, ponds, ponds abounding in lotuses, groves producing flowers, fruits, and medicines, the discovery of gold, jewels, and other precious substances, methods pointing out the signs of the sun, moon, and planets, stars, constellations, movements of the earth, omens, dreams, and the characteristics of coordination of general and specific actions and forms. I've got to read this as a long one. The characteristics of coordination of general and specific actions and forms of limbs and parts of the body. Points of cultivation of discipline. meditation. Okay, meditation's in there too as a job. Good. Mystic knowledge, the immeasurables and formless states, and whatever else is not harmful or injurious, and that which is conducive to the benefit and well-being of all creatures, that the enlightening beings undertake, guided by compassion, to establish them in the way of Buddhas. Isn't that nice? Buddhas. Sorry, I kind of swallowed that word. So the foremost transcendent practice in this stage is Jhana Paramita, the practice of meditation.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, isn't that great? So they need the practice of meditation in order to do all these things without picking and choosing and without a self. So,
perfect.
Pretty good. All right. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the sixth stage, presence, also called presence of unattached knowledge. So the bodhisattvas enter this stage by way of the 10 equality of things, equalities of things. All right, let me read the 10, or some of them. I'm going to read this from the commentary because it's a little bit condensed. Practitioners enter this stage of presence by observing phenomena in terms of their equality, in having no ultimate definition, in having no fixed origin, in being apart from any concept or notion of things, in being primordially pure, in neither coming nor going, in being existent in some sense and non-existent in another, and in being like dreams or reflected images. They observe the formation and disintegration of worlds. They realize that the origins of worldly ways are all rooted in attachment to self. So that's how they enter the stage of presence of unattached knowledge. And then, once they're there, they become aware of the 12 links of codependent origination. And there's a long section about all different ways to look at the 12 links. And there was another chapter that I taught on in a previous session where there were all different ways to look at the Four Noble Truths. But my sense is that I know I myself am not as steeped and familiar with the teachings on the 12 links. And I think maybe, you know, I know Fish is, but I don't know if everyone else is. So I thought looking at it from all different angles probably wouldn't be as helpful to us, and especially not in Sishin. It's kind of like a lot of information. So you can read it.
So which is?
It's chapter 26. Yeah, this is all from 26, and it's a stage of presence. I can give you the page numbers. So I could just say what the 12 links are, just briefly, just, you know, and but I'm not going to go into immense detail. So this is a system of understanding, you could say, karmic life. And in some Buddhist systems, it's really thought of as like the first link, you know, it sort of leads to that you're born, how you're born, and then you die. And then it goes around in a circle like that. But there's other ways to teach it where it's like each moment or, you know, in your life, you're going around and around in the 12 links, which I think to me is a more helpful way of thinking about it. So the first is ignorance, which refers to ignorance of the Four Noble Truths, and in particular, ignorance about dukkha, or that life is unsatisfactory, or that there's suffering in life. And that not realizing that the teaching of no separate self. So then it's suffering. So there's the ignorance there. And then from ignorance produces what's called volitional action. So it's a impulse, motivation, We don't understand the truth, so we have the impulse that leads us to actions that's just going to continue on this samsaric path, this path of suffering. And then the action leads to consciousness, and consciousness here isn't thinking, but the basic awareness. In Buddhism, it said there's eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose consciousness, tongue consciousness, body consciousness, and mind consciousness. So it's the consciousness through the senses, which the mind is considered one. So that's the next link, and then right away, name and form. So that's when matter joins with the sense consciousness. Do I have that right?
It's the mind, like how we our preferences maybe come into play. Labeling.
Yes. Yeah. So that's name and form. So yeah. So we have the illusion that there's a distinct thing here because of the consciousness, and then there it is. And then the six senses, sort of come together to give us the illusion of an independent individual. So shown as a, and there's actually in the Wheel of Life, there's pictures in each one. So this one is shown as a house with six windows. So like it's coming in six ways. Oh, that's great. And then the next is sense impressions. So that's contact between the individual sense faculties and the outer environment. And the Wheel of Life illustrates this as an embracing couple. Sense impressions. And then feelings, the recognition and experience of the preceding sense impressions as subjective feelings. So in Buddhism, we talk about just three main types of feelings: pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So that's the feelings part. And the craving, once there are feelings, then desire or craving arises. So that's the next link. So if we're not mindful, then we're just pulled around by craving. And the Wheel of Life illustrates this as a man drinking beer, usually surrounded by empty bottles. So it's not just one beer, it's a bunch. And then attachment, the attached and clinging mind. We're attached to many things: sensual pleasures, mistaken views, external forms and appearances. Most of all, we cling to the illusion of an ego and the sense of that individual self. And this is usually illustrated by a monkey or a person reaching for a fruit. So like attachment. So that's kind of the craving and attachment in a way together. And then 10 is becoming. So that's set in motion. You know, all of these, you know, if one leads to the other, that's why they're called links. So the force of attachment keeps us bonded to this life of suffering, and then, you know, then we are leading toward the next one, which is birth. So becoming and then birth. And then birth, the next link is old age and death. So there's nothing, you don't get to have a long life in between. There might be a long life in between, but really, the next link after birth is old age and death. Do you want to say anything else? So this is like whirlwind.
I often do it with an analogy of like grasping after something that you really crave. Like a friend of mine did it around a pair of orange shoes that she really wanted. And the grasping is the justification of why you deserve those orange pairs of shoes. And becoming is like the actual putting into action the purchasing of those shoes. And the birth is then the joy of now having those pairs of orange shoes and old age birthday baskets that I don't care about them anymore.
Yeah, or even if I do, eventually they'll get dirty, they'll get worn out, they'll die.
Which is more subtle is I think that no matter how much we want something now.
Yeah, when we get it.
It no longer fulfills that satisfaction. It
doesn't have that pull anymore. Yeah.
It's even more tedious for me.
That's good.
And you throw them in the trash.
All right.
It's kind of relinquishment.
Yeah. So one of the teachings of the Four Noble the 12 Links is that from the idea of that this is this wheel of suffering and you have to get off. Like that's the goal, is to get off. You know, to not keep entering that. Whereas the different angle in the Mahayana, which is, you know, Zen is included and the flower ornament scripture definitely comes from that point of view, is that that's not exactly the goal, to get off. Because the bodhisattvas say, no, I'm not going to ultimate cessation. I'm not going to try to get off because I need to stick around to help the beings who are there, who are still there. So I think about like that series of books that was popular a while back, Left Behind, which was from the Christian, you know, theology of like at the rapture, all the good, you know, upright people will go up into heaven and then people will be left behind. And so these books were stories about the people left behind. And I would tell my friends when, like, well, in my religion, we elect to stay behind. Even if we could go up there, we elect to stay behind and help the suffering beings. So that's the bodhisattva's mission. And let's see, I can say something about that. It says here, this is what the enlightening beings are thinking. But we should not go to the ultimate cessation of the created for the sake of the full development of sentient beings. This abode of transcendent wisdom encountered by enlightening beings examining the many ills, so, you know, looking at the suffering, is called the presence of unattached knowledge. So that's this stage, and is realized by undertaking great compassion and not abandoning duty to living beings. There's a few different places in this sutra where it says this phrase about the bodhisattvas vowing not to abandon living beings. And I'm always really moved by that language, not abandoning. They, the bodhisattvas, also observe the essential nullity of conditioned states, but they do not settle down into that. So they do recognize that what is happening, like in this wheel. They recognize, oh, this is a wheel of suffering, and it isn't actually real. The ultimate truth applies. So they recognize that, but they don't settle into it. So that's, I think, an important thing. The enlightening beings in this stage, the stage of presence, realize the concentration of enlightening beings called entry into emptiness. So this is really like about the Heart Sutra here, I think. They attain absorption and emptiness of inherent nature, emptiness of ultimate reality, supreme emptiness, great emptiness, emptiness of union, emptiness of concern, emptiness of disconnection and non-disconnection. With these 10 doors of concentration on emptiness in the forefront, 100,000 doors of concentration on emptiness become manifest to them, and so do 100,000 doors of concentration on signlessness and 100,000 doors of concentration on wishlessness. And in the next stage, it talks about the bodhisattvas entering into signlessness, wishlessness, and what was the other one? Oh, it just says signlessness, wishlessness, aimlessness. Yeah, it doesn't say aimlessness here, but yeah, aimlessness. talks about in the next stage. So the foremost transcendent practice in this stage of presence is prajnaparamita, the perfection of wisdom, of course, yeah. So that's what I have on these two stages. And if there's comments or questions, yes?
Well, you know, just in a kind of more baby way of mm-hmm. understanding this, I was thinking about how it's like when my daughter brings some drama, teenage drama, it's a real, you know, suffering. And like, mm-hmm. I can see from a different vantage.
Right.
So, okay, I'm not
yeah.
like an enlightened Buddhist.
Yeah, oh, you can see.
Like,
yeah.
as an adult,
mm-hmm.
you can see. And I can see.
Uh-huh.
But it is not helpful. That's
to
not.
To point that out. No.
Like, I have to go. In
right.
In a way,
mm-hmm.
I have to, when I'm at my best,
uh-huh.
I'm not holding, you know,
uh-huh.
I'm totally, like,
yeah.
I have to enter in.
Mm-hmm.
But not enter in and grab.
Uh-huh.
It's, I don't know. Anyway, that's what I think of just a regular way this comes
yeah.
up. The little, like, mirror of big.
Yeah, I think about that. Just reminds me of the story of Ling Zhao, Shining Grasses, the story from the Pong family, where
oh, yeah.
the daughter and the father are walking along, going to town to sell baskets or something, and the father stumbles and falls, and so Ling Zhao throws herself down, and Layman Pong says, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I saw you fall, so I'm helping." And that's like that.
Yeah.
Just like, I'm just going to go right to where you are,
yeah.
you know, honey, as
yeah.
you're suffering this teenage drama. Yeah.
Something Tenshin Roshi said to me a while ago when I was dealing with my own daughter's quagmire, and I said to him, it's so hard to be on the sidelines watching. At that retreat, he had spoken about a circus, carnival ride that he had been on where it goes around and there's, and he always chose to be in the center where it was still and all these people were on the mountain.
Oh, I remember that.
And people let him be in the center. But he said, your daughter is in the center and you're not an observer, you have to be right there standing next to her. You know, not like a helicopter parent, just like standing there for when she needs to rely on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been so helpful
mm-hmm.
to me. And it's
mm-hmm.
just.
Yep.
You know, and I guess it's being unattached to the outcome.
Mm-hmm. Anyone else? All right. Thank you very much. We can do the closing chant now. We'll do a closing chant.